the way that they lived was who they were, and their work, it was all one, you know? The beliefs that they had, very strong, but calm, not pushy, not forcing it on anybody else. This is how we are. Come join us. Come join us.
They had a very open house and a very open kind of attitude, I think, to the world. So it always felt like they were involved in about 20 different projects, and there would always be people around, interesting people to talk to. Yeah, they were strongly ethically driven, I would say, a big sense of social responsibility, environmental responsibility. Margaret would always be experimenting with dyes, or she would send me little packages of skeins that she'd dyed with something that we had found on a walk. She always had things on the go. They both did. And Grandpa kept corresponding with people all over the world. I mean, as long as he could, I think. And they were still going to conferences. They were still teaching themselves and having those conversations. Well, I don't think they ever really retired. They were always part of so many conversations, and I think there was never a sense of it being, oh, this is just for us. It was always very open.
So he would live a certain code of Quakerism, which is a very simple, it's a Christian faith, but it preaches simplicity. There are no people, no priests or anything between an individual and a higher being. So there's a simplicity of belief. At his heart is peace and quiet. So he would meditate to decide what he wanted to do. He had that moral code that constantly taught us. And it was silently taught. He wasn't preaching about it. Now, Mum was different. She was a very free-spirited individual, very free-spirited. So that, you know, she was very people-focused.
Quakerism, the religious society of Friends, has no elaborate hierarchy, no priesthood standing between the individual and the divine. Instead, there is a quiet conviction that there is God in everyone. It is a simple idea, yet it has profound consequences. If every life carries equal worth, then listening becomes an ethical act. Authority becomes something shared rather than imposed. Care extends beyond people to the earth itself, whose resources are not possessions, but a trust held in common. Quakers call this living one's testimony. Faith is not measured by what is professed, but how one lives. Historically, this has led Friends to oppose slavery, to reform prisons, to refuse war, and to campaign for peace, equality, and justice. They describe this as social witness, the belief that inner conviction should find its expression in public life. What interested me was not simply this history, but how it could be recognised in the ordinary texture of Margaret and David's lives. It seemed to shape everything. Their creative practice, the way they approached business, the care with which they treated people around them, and their attentiveness to the natural world. I began this project believing I was documenting a craft. I slowly realised I was encountering an ethic.
It's so important to have that contact with someone that wasn't school, wasn't family, who encouraged, and how it made me feel. It's like halfway between someone opening doors and leading you through. It's having a vision now, like when an adult is teaching a child to swim, that sort of gentle hand.
Gentle, peaceful, loving, caring, and determined to share everything they knew as much as they possibly could, trying to make the impact on the earth less and less. You know, that good Quaker ethos of caring for the environment that they lived in. A love of the natural world around them and the colours they saw in the natural world around them, and a deep love of art and the whole, you know, visual world. An enthusiasm for the people that they managed to help by bringing colour to, you know, yarns and colours that were beginning, you know, when they were right at the forefront of the movement towards, back towards natural dyeing, and being a company that only dealt with natural dyes. They were creating enthusiasm, and I think that has pushed the boundaries further on. It will only be in several more generations as to whether they're still talked about, whether they're still recognised for what they were, at the forefront of really pushing natural dyeing forward, of really creating a way of thinking that possibly we are, as an industrial world, we need to rethink ourselves.
In 1971, it was a time when a lot of people were disillusioned with the state of the world, and so there were a lot of dropouts and hippies, and a lot of us came to Pembrokeshire as to work in arts and crafts and creative work, that sort of thing. And I always think that part of this was influenced by John Seymour, who published a new complete book of self-sufficiency. He lived in Pembrokeshire as well, and actually his wife was a potter who we were associated with. But in 1972, a group of 14 of us got together to form the Pembrokeshire Craftsman Circle. This included David and Margaret, and the circle met monthly at Wallace Wooler Mill, where the theme of the organisation was to promote high-quality art and craft and design in Pembrokeshire through advertising and exhibitions. And we organised annual exhibitions for a few years and that sort of thing. And it was a great team, great gang of people, if you like, yeah. They fitted in with this sort of outlook of alternative environmentally aware and wanting to live a more satisfying life. Mostly I remember them as for their calm, well-spoken manner. He called me dear boy very often. I was never aware of their membership of the Quakers, but looking back, I now understand that a lot of their outlook to life was a result of their Quaker belief and approach to the world, resulting in their very calm and respectful approach to people in general.
I mean, initially they employed a lot of local people, and that was central to the early successes. But later they got invited to those conferences in India, and so they had an international reach. And I think people, partly because of the beauty of their products, what they created, partly because of the beauty of them as people, people were drawn to them. People were drawn to their natural dyes because of they're a bit ahead of their time, I think. Because in Pembrokeshire in the 70s, there was a lot of hippies descended on Pembrokeshire in the 60s and 70s. So there was a community there that resonated with what Mum and Dad were doing in the Craftsman Circle, the group of craftsmen who fed off each other and produced amazing things. I think, to me, I would say it was their values. I think it's how they lived their lives and how that impacted so many people that they interacted with. And obviously the beauty of Renaissance products. But I think it's the memory of how you can live your life in a wholesome, kind and generous way, try and make a positive difference.
I think they made a lot of connections with people in different ways. So, you know, they were very passionate in terms of craft in general, not just their own things. So they were part of things like Craftsman Circle and encouraging understanding of craft. I think it keeps coming back to that kind of encouragement and sharing their world and listening to other people's world. It keeps coming round to that, I think, so that the things they did in their lives show that. It wasn't just about their work, it's about other people as well.
There was these tours they set up, travelling from a mill to a pottery to a woodworker's workshop. So they did a lot to try and support, nurture and encourage creative activity throughout the county. It wasn't specific to the mill. School visits. Dad really encouraged school. He loved having children, loved having showing children how a loom worked. None of them knew where wool came from. You know, it was a real shock. Because Dad said, there's a gap in their education. Kevin, go and make a film. It's called The Story of Wool, and it started up on a farm in the Preseli's, and then it came in through the spinning and the dyeing, and then into the mill, and then it was woven. Just in about 20 minutes, it told a little story, bringing back things that have been lost or forgotten, not necessarily lost, but forgotten, and opening people's hearts and minds and imaginations to the beauty of natural dyes and moving us away from chemical dyes and all the constituent parts of that, the pollution and everything else. They gained an enormous amount of respect within the wider community, you know, because they kept going. They'd not stopped. They'd had a few knockbacks, but they kept going. You know, they just soldiered on. And, you know, even when Mum was really sort of retired, they didn't believe in retirement. They would run dye courses in their 80s. You know, they'd go out to field study centres and introduce people to natural dyes. And I love that. That sort of, they never stopped learning. That's the beautiful thing. That's their legacy to me, is just don't stop. Don't stop learning about life and about contributing to the world around you.
Certainly the importance of creating beauty in the world and trying to understand the world and trying to leave a positive mark by the time you've gone.
During the months I spent with the archive, the wider world became increasingly difficult to comprehend. Wars multiplied. Images of genocide entered our homes through the small screens we held in our hands. The language of politics grew more divisive. Climate records were broken with alarming regularity. Governments continued to speak of growth, while the conditions that make life possible steadily eroded. It felt as though the scale of these crises exceeded any meaningful response an individual might make. Against this backdrop, Margaret and David's practice appeared almost impossibly modest. And yet I have come to think that this modesty may be its strength. Their lives suggest that our potential future world is not built through declarations alone, but through habits repeated over time. Sharing knowledge instead of accumulating it. Caring for places instead of extracting from them. Measuring prosperity not by speed or growth, but by the quality of our relationships. This is not withdrawal from the world. It's another way of participating in it. When we are called upon to build a world, we rarely do so alone. It depends upon other people. Shared labour, shared knowledge, shared responsibility. It depends upon conversations that remain open rather than hierarchical, upon learning that moves in many directions instead of flowing from the top down. It asks us to replace competition with cooperation, extraction with reciprocity. These values are not abstract principles. They become visible through everyday practice. If there is hope here, it is not because these practices will solve every crisis we face. It is because they refuse the assumptions that produce those crises in the first place. They teach another rhythm of living, slower, more attentive, more collaborative. A world is built this way, not all at once, but through the routine maintenance of care, repeated day after day. It is never complete. It is never perfect. Perhaps this is another kind of resilience. Self-sufficiency in the sense of being able to depend upon one another. To understand that landscapes hold memory, that culture is encoded in the places we inhabit, and that our responsibility is not ownership but participation. Cooperation, collaboration, and the collective imagination allow us to seek wisdom, not only from those beside us, but from those who came before us. I have not become a Quaker through making this work, but I have found myself asking different questions. How might I live in a way that leaves the world more connected than I found it? How might my work become a form of witness?